Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. My responses cover subjects of general interest, such as human relationships, career, and morality, but not current politics. My answers are posted every week on Mondays, and you can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes on my website. Several years of podcasts are now easily searchable by topic or keywords. If you have a philosophical question to ask me, simply go to www.peikoff.com, and that's spelled P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F, like the word off, peikoff.com. And of course, feel free to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. My issue is jealousy and anger in regard to what my partner did sexually in the period before she knew me. I know it is something that can never be changed, and she has declared that her sexual acts were in no way an expression of love on her part. But isn't she immoral for not refraining from these activities if she believed that someone out there like me existed? I would ask, first of all, what kind of partners did she pick? If they were partners that were of significant value to her, men that she respected, men that she admired, even though she didn't love them, there is nothing whatever wrong with that. There is no issue that you have to be in love in order to have valid or moral sex. There has to be values, important values, but love is a very unique situation where not only are there values, but the form that those values take in this person is indispensable, is irreplaceable. So she is not at all immoral, and let's assume that if she was, you know, a slut, sleeping around, whatever, then you don't need to worry about what to do. You say, isn't she immoral? She didn't wait to find you. Absolutely not. How does she know if you're out there or how long it's going to take her to find? Now, if she didn't look, you could say, you know, she's not even trying, settling for somebody that's not her love. But suppose she was looking, but she's starving. She can't find anybody. Or maybe it will be years. You want her to be in that state just because of a maybe? That is not immoral at all. It's wrong of you to expect her to expect you. She's not omniscient. Now, let's suppose, though, even the worst is she was promiscuous in the past because of desperation. She didn't know what to do. If you love her now, if she is a great value to you now, even if she had a past which you disapprove, if you think that's all behind her now and she really loves you, then I would say to you, forget the past, throw it out. She's the person that she is now. Now, of course, if you don't believe that she really loves you, then get out of it. But in either case, don't be jealous. Either she is what you want now or she isn't. And that she didn't spend her time looking for you or waiting for you. You know, it was like saying a person who has no food and you're the caterer down the block and she's eating who knows what. And you say, you should have waited and died of hunger because I'm going to come that way in 30 years. You can't ask that. 30 years or 30 minutes. My parents have made me an heir to a small fortune. Their philosophies are opposed to my own. My father's a religious mystic, my mother an altruist. What should be my attitude, considering I have the opportunity to gain a lot of money if we stay on good terms? Well, money is certainly a value, and I'm assuming that they're leaving it to you as what you are, as their child, and not as an exponent of their ideas. Now, the will says, give it to him only if he attends church, you know, etc., or he joins the Peace Corps, whatever it is, that's a different thing. But if the will just gives it to you, the question is, will you stay on good terms? I would say, yeah, you can stay on good terms. That's perfectly fine, so long as you don't lie outright to them. In other words, if they force the issue, demand your agreement, then you can't define good terms as justified to lie to them. But what you should do in a case like this is just try to avoid argument. Try to avoid discussions. You can be very polite, be very friendly, but you can do basically what politicians do on the air when you ask them, what did you do last week? They say the monetary future of the Federal Reserve is very important. People accept that on TV. You do it a little more smoothly, but you can very often do that. There's no lying. You're still being polite. Even if you decide you can't take them, I have to get out of here, you can still stay on good terms in the sense of you explain to them the problem, you appreciate the good things they've done, and you enumerate them, you break politely, you wish them the best, etc. They could still leave you all the money. So you present it as though the choice is I become them or I tell them to go to hell. And that is not the choice. Is it rational for an atheist to have feelings of awe, A-W-E, at life, the earth, and the universe? Now, this is a really interesting question because I never thought about this. Now, the dictionary basically says that awe is a combination of admiration and fear. It has to be, the object has to be something that you regard as grand, but in some way so out of the ordinary as to inspire some kind of doubt. I would define that doubt not as fear in the sense of something is going to happen to you, but as a sense of metaphysical disorientation, a brief metaphysical disorientation. That's what differentiates awe from admiration. It's as though you feel when you have awe, this is unreal. It's impossible. It's great, but I can't imagine how this thing could exist. If you have that about something you consider a great value, you have a momentary dislocation where you feel, if reality allows this, where am I? Because it didn't fit what I thought was possible. Now, I can't have that feeling toward anything except the human realm. I look at life, the earth, and the universe. I just take that for granted. They're here. So that's part of my very concept of reality. So I never look at it and say, wow, this really goes beyond the norm. But I do have it in human cases. I think the major case in my life was the first night or two with Ayn Rand. Not every night, because after a while she became, part of the nature of reality, one of the objects in reality. But the first night, I was aware, even as a kid at that time, how grand, how powerful, what a force she was. But I also had a feeling that it's impossible. How can anybody be like this? I didn't doubt it, but it was like I was taken aback with a sense of, if this is possible, if what she lives is reality, where am I living? Why am I not like that? And that was, it's a kind of doubt, and not a serious self-doubt, but it's a kind of, I don't know how to put it other than a reorientation metaphysically, that there's a whole dimension of the world that you didn't know, a wonderful dimension. It's that combination. It's not just a dimension like, oh, it's a computer, which I never imagined. It's got to be something that changes your view of how your life would be lived, or at least some crucial part of your life. So that, I would say, to me, is the arch example. Now, I have had smaller examples, but, they're within the profession where I've had this feeling. I'll give you just one. In my life, I have struggled to write 3 books. And there is a writer called Isaac Asimov, who is, by the way, a good writer. He doesn't write junk. He writes fiction and nonfiction, many of which I've read. I have not got the exact number. I should have looked it up. But he has written, in total, 430 books, or 440, something like that. And when I saw that, I felt like a smaller version of what I felt when I met Ayn Rand. It was like, is there such a reality that you can write 400 and whatever books that are good in a lifetime when I'm, you know, killed myself to eke out the third? It's that same feeling of a metaphysical, I thought that was admirable beyond conception. If I want to think of something admirable, I go to that, because it just stunned me. I never dreamed. I knew people turned out huge number of books, but the ones I looked at were all trash. So I still don't know how this guy did it. Anyway, that gives you an idea of my view of awe in a major and a lesser way. Is there a rationale in cheering for a particular sports team, usually one's home team? Or shouldn't an objective is cheer for the winning team, any winning team, because that's a team that possesses the values and skill to be successful? No, I don't agree with that at all. You admire and enjoy skilled play and players on either team. But cheering for a team, you cheer for a team that you've chosen as yours. Maybe because you saw a special skill on it, or even you were brought up with it, or you know the experience of some of the players, or you've gone through some of the heartbreak World Series, I'm thinking of baseball, with them, and they are your team. Now, I don't think you are in any way minimizing the skill and the values of other teams. But you have chosen this. I think it's a parallel to love. You can admire values in women, but you choose one as yours. And then you know, if there was a contest in, let's say, a Scrabble between the two, even if the other was more skillful, this is your woman. And I don't see anything against, I think it's much more fun. Even watching horses, which I do sometimes, it's much more fun saying, I'm for this one. Of course, even more fun if you put a lot of money on him. But you want to have something you're cheering for in a sports spectacle. That's my opinion. If John Galt's motor was a reality, and someone from the Obama administration, say from the Department of Energy or Transportation, discovered a working Galt motor, what do you think they would do with it? I think they would hide it, cover it up, drop it in the ocean the way they did Osama bin Laden, or ban it. Remember, I regard the essence of these people's attitude, at least in regard to industrial phenomena, as nihilism. I don't regard the goal of the Greens as positive, but as destructive, that ultimately to end the Industrial Revolution. So they don't want to provide alternative energy. They want to annihilate sources of energy. And therefore, if they found another source, you are deluding yourself if you think, oh, they'd be so happy, now we don't need to get our energy from the Middle East. It would just be another problem for them. But, you know, if once they discovered it, they would take it over and it wouldn't work anyway, so there wouldn't have to be a problem. How would an objectivist respond to the discovery of intelligent extraterrestrial life? Well, it depends on a lot of factors. First of all, is communication, conceptual communication, possible? Because without that, they are in the category of animals to us. But you say intelligent. Can we communicate through our different intelligences? That's one essential to a peaceful relation. Second, do they have built-in needs, values of their physical or psychological structure, which are incompatible, clashing with ours? You know, they have to eat a lot of human liver in order to survive. Or our wheat crops emit a chemical that's harmful to them. Well, if that's the case, we're enemies by physical structure, and war is the only alternative. There's no fix that I can see as I set it up. Third would be important. We could have a flourishing relationship, be friendly, if there was something we can get from each other. If we can be of pleasure to each other, intellectual value, skills we can teach, whatever, on whatever level, then of course we can, just like with other people, an individual to other people, there would be no problem. The big problem I would see would be, what is their physical body like? Are they androids? Are they man-like? Or are they intelligent, rational spiders or snakes? Now, even if there were such thing as rational spiders, and they could communicate and teach us, you know, how to build better computers and so on, I don't see that there could be much interconnection, much love, much integration between humans and these people. We wouldn't have to go to war with them. I just don't see the human race and the spider race happily coexisting and intermarrying. Now, maybe that's because I'm mired in my early 20th century birth, and I just haven't got the ability to foresee that. But the fact is, I don't have that ability. If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peikoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most famous novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Thanks for listening.